Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to the Hot Takes Podcast, where we like to discuss Star Wars. I'm Haley Birdwell.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Eric Geller.
And today we have a very special guest, my colleague David French of The Dispatch, who is here to discuss the merits of the film Aquaman. Actually, he's here to discuss the dark side, Darth Bane, and the Rule of Two, which he could talk about for hours. We are very excited to have him here with us today.
I can discuss Darth Bane almost as long as I can discuss Aquaman.
David, before we started recording, you mentioned that you have a personal story, a personal history with Darth Bane. Would you like to begin with that?
I do. Well, so Darth Bane came along at a very important point in my Star Wars life because the prequels had just finished. So Darth Bane, the book of Darth Bane, Path of Destruction, by Drew Karpashian, is published in 2006, which is the year after Revenge of the Sith comes out. And to describe the prequels as sort of crushingly disappointing is a little bit of an understatement for me. The Phantom Menace, I pretend, never happened. Like, it doesn't exist in my brain. Most of the Attack of the Clones never happened. Revenge of the Sith is not bad. Like, it's not bad. But the problem that I had was Star Wars just wasn't cool anymore. Like, I didn't get into the lore of it. Like, I didn't get into the history of it anymore. And I had this, like, sort of crushing disappointment in the Jedi from the prequels because the Jedi were so mysterious and cool in the original trilogy. And then, you know, you start off with Phantom Menace, and it's like they're lopping off heads to maintain ketchup subsidies to Alderaan. I mean, it felt like it was like a UN peacekeeping force. I mean, what on earth? And so along comes Darth Bane, and it's got this sort of ancient lore feel to it. The Jedi are much more interesting. The Sith are both a combination of intriguing and a total mess. And then you have this, this really compelling character in the middle of it. And then, you know, just when you feel like you're sort of exhausting his story, you have his apprentice come along who is even more compelling in a lot of ways. And so I just have to say Darth Bane, the Darth Bane trilogy, just sort of rekindled my enthusiasm for the Star Wars universe.
So this episode is actually a long time coming. At one point, my colleagues discovered that I was a co-host of a Star Wars podcast and were mercilessly mocking me in the company Slack. But David took the opportunity to send me a message saying that he must come onto the podcast to discuss this book, this trilogy. And I tried to read the book. I made it through the first one, David, and it was hard for me. There were parts of it that I liked that were interesting. But it was difficult because I am a wimp and he was so evil. Like, I needed a good guy. And even the good guys were a mess.
They're a mess.
Grace actually read it recently. I know Eric read, I believe, all three of them at one point.
Long ago.
I literally finished the book 2 days ago. I read this explicitly for the podcast. And I started off it really... The first part of it really hooked me. So for those of us who have not read the book, for those of you who have not read the book, it's about this guy, Dessel. He's on a mining colony. His life is garbage. he's had a really rough childhood. Things are not going well for him. And basically, he, through a crazy turn of events, is able to join the Sith Academy on the planet Korriban, and it takes place 1,000 years before the prequels and original trilogy, I believe. But something that I thought was really cool about the first portion of the book was how it shows that this poor guy... He has a miserable life, and there is a point early on in the book where he's playing a card game with a bunch of Republic soldiers, and the Republic soldiers are trying to convince him to join the army, And he's like, what has the Republic ever done for me? What have the Jedi ever done for me? They're supposedly peacekeepers, but my life sucks. And the Jedi don't care about the little people of the universe, and neither does the Republic. And I was like, yeah, you know what? You get him.
He has a point.
He has a point. So I really liked that element of it. We can talk later about the elements that I really did not like, but that element I thought was really interesting.
I feel obligated to point out that this book is from the Expanded Universe, so if you are a newer Star Wars fan and you're wondering why you haven't heard of this book or where it fits into the timeline, it doesn't. It's not canon. It's from the old continuity that they crossed off, essentially. Don't email me, but I just wanted to mention that.
Which is garbage.
That they crossed this. There's nothing inconsistent.
A can
with
of
this
worms.
Trilogy.
A can of worms is being opened here that I'm going to shove back into the can.
Okay. Sorry.
This was actually my first foray into the expanded universe, and part of it that I liked. I grew up watching Star Wars and the Clone Wars and all of these things. I really enjoyed seeing, a time where the Sith and the Jedi were almost equal in number, and what warfare between those two groups looked like, which looked like a lot of, especially for the Sith, using people as pawns, a lot of carnage, a lot of bloodshed. But it was interesting to sort of see what those battles looked like. And eventually it sort of just comes into this quagmire where they're just like all on one planet, just like losing people every day. And of course we see later in the book how Darth Bane uses that to his advantage. But like I said, I sort of struggled to finish it. It was pretty dark. But one of the things that he comes up with is the rule of two. And that's sort of what he was known for even before these books. And that basically is how the Sith proceeded after that, which is there is always a master to wield ultimate power, and then there is always the apprentice. And ultimately those apprentices either have to prove they're worthy by killing the master and taking their place, or if they're not able to, they're sort of cast off and they're proven unworthy. So he sort of comes up with that idea. And I know David has thoughts on this because he sent an email to our interns when they were starting this year to ask their thoughts on this rule of two.
Wow. That honestly might be dorkier than anything I've ever heard of before.
David, I am interested in what you think. Do you support the rule of two? Do you think it has merit?
Yeah. So the reason why I found these books compelling because I like it when a book a fantasy universe sort of explores its own internal logic, and in a way that's sort of consistent and recognizable with the way we would recognize in the real world. And the thing that I thought was really interesting about it was how, the Sith army, what he realizes, they're just never going to get it together. There's just too many Dr. Evils. I mean, there's just too many competing power centers. There's just too much rivalry. There's just too much division. I mean, these are people who are ultimately self-interested, who are uniting. And what he realized was if you're going to have this sort of ultimately self-interested kind of worldview, then it's never going to be broad. There has to be one ruler. There cannot be lots of competing power centers. And so this whole sort of idea but there also has to be continuity. Like if the Sith are not immortal, so there has to be continuity. And I just thought it was a really interesting way of dealing with the conundrum of how do you, not that I'm trying to figure out how to deal with this in my own life, but how do
as
you
far as we know.
establish a continuity of rule of sort of pure self-interested evil? And that, and I thought the fundamental quote of the rule of two, there should be two, no more, no less, one to embody the power, the other to crave it. It's just a kind of a cool and sinister formulation. And I think fantasy fiction is only as good as its villains. And these are some, and he's a pretty formidable villain.
Eric, what do you think of the rule of two?
Well, there is something to be said for if you want your organization to succeed and to thrive, you need to create a structure that, you know.
You need synergy.
You need to have the people who are part of it want to continue it, right? Otherwise, it goes away when they go away. And so you need to encourage the person who already has made it to the top of the mountain to sort of at least somewhat pull somebody up with them, right? Not maybe not the whole way, but give them the tools to climb the rest of the way and see whether they can do it. On the other hand, if you killed your master, you know, and you didn't watch your master die a natural death at the age of 105, you have personal experience with the fact that sometimes the master gets cut off in their prime or on their way to completing some goal. And so you've got to be worried about that from this other person. So why are you preparing them to do it? I mean, I get the idea of if you're good enough, then you deserve to do it. But we never seem to see that actually happen. It's always the master thinking that the apprentice isn't ready yet, and the master having their own plans, and the master getting interrupted in the middle of their own plans. It's not like the master sits down and it's like, well, I've done everything I want to do, and you're ready now, and so it's time for you to kill me. Like, it never actually works for the master the way that you would think this kind of system would work, given how long it has lasted.
Well, the whole purpose of it is that the power is then seized. It's seized in turn, each by, and so you cannot have relinquishing of the power to be utterly inconsistent with the philosophy.
Right.
So the power has
right.
to be seized. But the interesting thing is, so when you read all the books, one of the interesting things is in book two, and spoilers, you know, if you're going to want to go read them. But in book two, Darth Bane is actually at the absolute total mercy of his apprentice at one point, and she doesn't kill him.
Right, yeah.
And why? Well, because in her mind, which is calculating entirely along the lines of self-interest, it's just too soon because she has more to learn. And so she doesn't want to kill him until she's ready to take that power. And so it was an interesting kind of calculus that was you don't want to call it a mercy, it was sort of a stay of execution while she could sort of like bleed him dry of all of his knowledge. It's all very diabolical and very fun to read.
So I'm not sure how I come down on this. When I first read it, I was like, this is not enough people. What if they both die? like nobody will pass on the knowledge.
By the way, that's why they never fly in the same plane.
Yeah. I was Googling. I was reading what the internet had to think about this earlier today in preparation. And people were like, well, there's holocrons and like there's ancient writing. So like, you know, someone could find their way back to where Darth Bane was if both of them had died. But I feel like that's a huge setback. Like, and one nail in the coffin here is it in later time, like when we see it in the films, it wasn't being followed. Like, secretly, the apprentices had their own apprentices. You have Count Dooku has Ventress. And Maul, for instance, while there's... I'm pretty sure Sidious was training Maul while he was still the apprentice for Plagueis. But in that case, Plagueis knew about Maul. So it's not exactly the same situation. But in all of those instances, the apprentices think that they're training their apprentice to come. And, like, even if they're saying to their master, like, oh, I'm just training an assassin of some kind. So it seems like even in the events where they're trying to follow this rule, they're still, out of self-interest, I will say, creating contingency plans.
The Sith are cheating on their rule?
Yeah. Shocking.
The bad guys? Something that I thought when reading about the rule of two, and maybe this was the purpose of the author in writing these books and having kind of a subtext, was just the dark side seems like a really bad path to go down. Now, I know that sounds very obvious. The bad guys are bad, but I'm speaking strictly strategically. It just doesn't seem like a really smart way to go. And I think part of that is the rule of two and knowing that you are constantly going to be looking over your shoulder because the apprentice that you are training is going to eventually have to kill you. And, you know, for those who want to preserve their own lives, I just don't really see the purpose of that. Like, maybe that just means I would be bad at being on the dark side, because the other, and this is slightly tangential, but the other thing about the dark side that I got while reading this book, there's a point kind of early on in the book where Dessel, now having become Bane, is beginning to use the dark side power more. And there's a point where he's like, when I'm using this power, it's good, but it's also like the darkness is feeding on me and eventually it's going to consume me. And it's like, who wants that?
it is funny to sort of think about, like, who would want to be a Sith and, like, the cost benefit there, because, like, yeah, I just don't understand why any, like, delusions of grandeur about galactic domination would be worth, like, that hypothetical idea that you could be the ultimate ruler of the universe, you know, is such a bad trade-off compared to the absolute certainty that your very vitality will be sucked out of your body and you will become a lifeless husk and probably killed before your time. It's such a bad deal. It's like the worst deal in Star Wars. It's like, what? Who? The odds are just not in your favor there.
It's as rational as meth addiction, but the meth is the Force. Like, the meth, and so, like, the way it seemed to me that this, that the way, you know, the author of these books crafted it was, you really got a glimpse, and as it went through the books 1, 2, and 3. That these guys are just sucking in power and expending power at a level that just at some point it seems like they just dwarf any given Jedi. Like, the Jedi have got to, you know, it takes it one Jedi is not going to take down one of these guys. And so, you know, part of the appeal, it seems to me, so if you're sort of thinking of, you're putting your Sith cap on, is these guys are sucking in Force power and consuming Force power and using it at a rate that just dwarfs that of the sort of more conventional trained Force sensitive people. And so that's how I kind of thought about it. Like, they're hitting that crack pipe of the Force. They're hitting that, you know, they're shooting
perfect
the heroin
phrase.
Of the, shooting the heroin of the Force. And so they're just as sort of rational in their addiction as any given addict is. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people who just sort of become burned out husks, but they are ready for the ride before they get there. And that's the way it struck me with Darth Bane, is this is a guy who just was ludicrously powerful and knew it. And couldn't let go of that.
David, what is your favorite, I don't know, scene, part of any of the books in the trilogy? Like, do you have a, like, you mentioned one of the characters, I think, who he takes as his apprentice. Do you have just something that you look back very fondly on?
Very fondly. I would say as interesting as the Bane, because I'm the kind of person, I like lore. Okay, so I like learning more about the ins and outs of these. So I was the kind of guy who, you know, when I talk about my favorite of the Tolkien books, it's the Silmarillion, because it's lore, baby. You know, like, it's the background. And, you know, I've read the appendices of Lord of the Rings as much as I've read Lord of the Rings. I like the lore. And so the Rain to Xana arc is even more interesting to me than Darth Bane. Because that she's a Sith sorceress. And it was always interesting to me. We had, you know, in my Star Wars life, I had references to Sith sorcery. What is Sith sorcery? And so diving into that side of it. And then, so the two parts that I think were particularly vivid in my mind was her discovery and Bane's immediate recognition of her power. And then the final confrontation between Xana and Bane in book three, and the interesting way in which that ends, which I don't want to spoil. But I found her arc to be actually more interesting than the Bane arc, because from a sort of that hyper nerd, like you're just mainlining nerdery, like diving into that world of what, like, of the Sith sorcery and that sort of deep Sith lore. I thought that was very interesting.
So I do want to discuss if the rule of two worked, because this sort of this sort of sets off over the next 1,000 years how they approach their, I don't know, goal of conquest for the galaxy. And ultimately you have Palpatine sort of maneuvering in the shadows and rising to power. But some critics have said you didn't really need the rule of two for that. You didn't even really need the Sith power for that. You just needed to be a really good politician, which he was. And so I am, and of course, you know, that it wasn't really long lived. The rule of two is sort of what ended that Sith reign of the galaxy, is when Darth Vader sort of rises up against him and then decides, I'm not going to claim the absolute power. What do you think of that? Do you think evil, the dark side, is always destined to lose? Is there a different strategy, a different rule that could have led to victory in some way?
Yeah, you know, you get the sense, and even in the sort of like the slugfest war between the Jedi and the, what was it, the Brotherhood of Darkness, that the Jedi are just kind of stronger, and that the Sith, if they're going to triumph, they're going to have to use subterfuge. As strong as any given individual Sith is, just sort of the whole dynamics of the way the Sith work is they're just too darn backstabbing to let somebody become so dominant. So therefore, they had to kind of go, the rule of two was sort of this default to necessity, allowing for and understanding the duplicity of the entire dark side. And so from that standpoint, it seemed as a strategy for maintaining a consistent strand of Sith influence, it seems relatively sound. But, you know, like many power mad movements, once they attain what they want, and once they have what they want, they're going to galvanize opposition nearly instantaneously. And so, you know, it's sort of like the dog who caught the car. that feels like the Sith. They're the dog that caught the car and then just went full evil with it and was going to galvanize the instantaneous reaction. But yeah, it is, from a strategic standpoint, if you take the understanding that the Jedi seem to have, because of their philosophy, a greater capacity to unite, and the Sith, because of their nature, a greater capacity to divide, that the rule of two then seems to make more sense.
Grace, I was going to ask you, what do you think of that? Do you think that the Brotherhood of, what was it, the Brotherhood of Darkness,
yes.
Was there any way forward for them to coordinate, to collaborate?
Yeah, as I've been thinking about this, you know, Star Wars as a whole is a very hopeful story, and the ultimate theme of Star Wars is that the light side is going to win, that the dark side will fall, and that ultimately the positive things in life will triumph over the negative things. And because of that, if you buy into the very philosophy that's just kind of woven into Star Wars, the dark side can never win. And therefore, the minions of the dark side can never win. And you really see that with the Brotherhood of Darkness, with all of these kind of backstabbing Sith lords trying to unite and failing. I think part of that is because the Sith lords are trying to unite under this one Dark Lord, Lord Khan, And he's really kind of useless. And the, yeah. the only reason that he has power over them is because he's very good at battle meditation, which is basically just allowing him to manipulate the other Sith. So, you know, maybe if there were a stronger leader, like maybe if Darth Bane had been the leader of the Brotherhood, they could have been more successful because he fundamentally understood what the Sith were trying to do and how to be strong Sith warriors, which is, as David said, through subterfuge and betrayal. But Bane very clearly does not want that, and in fact ends up destroying the Brotherhood in order to set the groundwork for the Rule of Two, which I thought was kind of, you know, self-defeating, but whatever.
You know what I think is hilarious? I was on the Wikipedia for Darth Bane, and I also have watched The Clone Wars, and there's like parts of Star Wars where Darth Bane sort of shows up and talks about what he did. And yeah, there's sort of some historic revisionism going on because he's like, the Sith destroyed themselves. And it's like, yeah. No, you manufactured that. You killed all of them. Now, that was pretty dark at the end there. Eric, what do you think about all this? You read all three of the books. Do you have any thoughts on, I don't know, Brotherhood of Darkness, Darth Bane, Rule of Two?
I mean, the one point in the favor of the Rule of Two is that, as others have said, the Sith as an institution are just not going to survive with a lot of them running around with a structure, anything like the Jedi Order. There's just no, they're not fundamentally capable of existing in that form because they give in to the kinds of emotions that are fundamentally destabilizing to any kind of institution. You can't have an institution made up of people who think that way. So if you want the nature of the Sith to survive in the galaxy over time, it can't happen with this kind of durable, large institution. It needs to be something smaller. Whether it needed to specifically be the Rule of Two, I don't know. You can imagine other ways of kind of seeding Sith ideology out there, having, you know, one person in this solar system, one person in that solar system, in a way where they don't feel like they have to compete with each other because they all have their own turf. But even then, maybe they develop larger ambitions. I mean, you can see that this is a fundamentally corrosive ideology when you're trying to have a durable institution. So ultimately, what he was trying to do is lay the groundwork for something that could last by playing on the ideology instead of playing against it. And listen, it lasted for a long time, at least in the expanded universe, so we can't really say that it was a bad idea because it lasted for much longer than we saw it fail for. We saw the failure over the course of a very narrow time span. Whether it's realistic that it lasted that long, I don't know. But, you know, Drew Karpyshyn, I guess, decided that he was going to, you know, make it, you know, 1,000 years of success. And so that's what we have in the expanded universe, at least.
By the way, can I just say, interject? Because for me, there's like lots of things that elevate good sci-fi or fantasy fiction. Cool lore. But other things is like just cool details, like battle meditation. Isn't that... Mm-hmm. Like a cool that's a fascinating
cool.
concept.
It's
yeah,
also
I think that was my
really
favorite
cool.
part.
It's also really cool to think about the Sith doing it because your first impression is that it's not necessarily something that they would be good at.
Right. Right. So, I mean, it's yeah. elevate. It's literally elevating the fighting power of others. Yeah. Yeah. It's that was just a cool touch.
Yeah, I liked that.
I also, speaking of the lore, that was some of my favorite aspect of the first book, was when he himself is looking into the lore and instead of relying on...
He hit the library.
Yeah, he hit the books. Reading makes you powerful, kids. That's the takeaway. But when he's ignoring his instructors, instead learning from the ancient Sith texts, and then later the Sith holocron, I thought that was really cool to have this sort of millennia-old repository of knowledge and have him drawing from that and sort of learning from the wisdom of his forebears. I thought that was a really nice touch where it's kind of the idea is the modern Sith have lost their way and he needs to go really deep back into the past to kind of understand the elements of the ideology. And so I think that where the first book, which is the only book I've read, although I have read the Darth Bane Wikipedia now, but where the first book for me really succeeds is in grounding the Sith and making them understandable as a force to be reckoned with and not just this one dude, Palpatine, who randomly has a plot to take over the galaxy. But no, this is the work of millennia. And I think that's pretty cool.
You know, that is one aspect I like, is it's sort of like natural selection. They're like, whoever is the strongest, you sort of refine the Sith over time. Yeah, I liked it. Like I said, it was a little evil for me.
It is dark. It is dark, but I tend to prefer like the darker entertainment, you know. So, although there are some, I will. I'm a fan of Ted Lasso and another very sweet show called Ghosts on HBO Max. Like super, like very sweet, spirited is good. But as a general rule, I veer towards the darker, the darker television, the darker books.
This does bring up my other question is, and I didn't read the Expanded Universe, so David and Eric, you might have more coherent thoughts on this than me. There's sort of this duality in Star Wars where there's good knowledge and evil knowledge, right? And one arc in Rebels, I'm sure you watched that, David, or at least I hope you would have watched that, is when Ezra... sort of, he finds this Sith holocron. I think Maul is like trying to bring him to the dark side, and he's using like knowledge that he's learned in this Sith information, and it seems sort of helpful to know how to do those things. And I like as someone here in this universe, I look at that and I'm like, why can't they just have both? Why can't they? And like, and as we know, Sith deal in absolutes, so. Like it's difficult to learn to master all of the dark side arts, and then you try to learn some of the light side stuff. But it feels like they would be much better, well-rounded individuals, maybe less genocidal if they, I don't know, dabbled in both more often.
You know, that's a really interesting point, because it feels to me like in sort of thinking through the logic of the metaphysics of the Star Wars universe, that when you are using Sith knowledge, you're drinking from a bad well.
Yeah.
And when you're using Jedi knowledge, you're drinking from that healthy well. And that you can't sip poison. and that seems to be sort of like one of the themes, is that even though in the short term, you know, that constant urge, do you give into your rage, if you draw from that well, and this is part of the Bane story, right? The more you draw from the well, the more it eats at your soul. And so it's just a dangerous, dangerous game to draw from that well, is sort of the moral logic of that part of the Star Wars universe, it seems to me.
Yeah.
That kind of reminds me of in the Jedi Temple, how they have the Jedi archives that only Jedi masters are allowed to access. And you read a little bit about this in the novelization of Revenge of the Sith. But it's the idea that even among the Jedi, that it's important to have this knowledge and this repository of what the Force can accomplish, but that it's too dangerous to be accessed by the general public. And so that makes you wonder, are the Jedi right? Can the public be entrusted with this kind of knowledge and make those decisions for themselves? Or is it wrong to keep that information away from people? And that kind of is the opposite of what you were saying, Haley, where it seems like there's not a lot of balance in the Sith side. Arguably, there's that lack of balance on the Jedi side as well, but I think David put it really well, that it's the ideas that fundamentally Sith knowledge is corrupting and that you can't use it and have balance because it itself is based on a kind of hungry power source.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Eric?
Well, I like to think of it with an analogy to sort of real world corruption of various kinds, moral corruption, political corruption. When you take advantage of something that is easy, that is a shortcut, that offers you a short-term reward, it's never just one and done. Because now that you've opened that door and you have seen the kind of life you can live if you take that shortcut, you take it again and again. And how many politicians have we heard about who do something wrong, might have had the opportunity to take an off-ramp and clean up their life, but end up going back to that well and ultimately are caught precisely because it becomes part of their routine. They no longer treat that as some kind of hush-hush thing that they have to be super careful with. It's just part of their life. And certainly you can think of all kinds of examples of sort of ethical and moral corruption outside of politics where you keep taking the shortcut and you keep relying on the shortcut. You eventually depend on the shortcut. You can't get around without it. David, you know, drew the analogy earlier to drug addiction. And I think that is the classic issue with the dark side, is that you can't just use it once. This goes all the way back to Empire Strikes Back, where Yoda talks about it as the quicker and easier path and says, if you go down this path once, you're locked into it. And at a certain point, there is no return. And that's obviously what, you know, what makes it so impressive for Luke to have that flare up of anger and then to step away from it in Return of the Jedi. So there's no real way to sort of say, well, you can have the Jedi powers, but then every once in a while, you should also try to understand the Sith side, try to use Force Lightning, use, you know, choke somebody. You know, it one of the things that's really interesting to me about like these powers is something like, you know, Force Lightning or choking somebody. I mean, those could seem like basic combat skills, especially the lightning, right? But one of the things I like about Star Wars is that it is part of the lore that some actions, even if in certain contexts they might seem like they are just neutral combat tactics, like any kind of lightsaber combat or whatever, they are just fundamentally wicked. They're fundamentally corrupting because the mindset of using them is just a corrupting mindset. I actually like that idea. I know it could seem to some little hokey, but I like the idea that there are certain things that you could do that when you're doing them, you're just drinking in a little bit more of that poison, and you're just making it more likely that you will think of doing that again in the future. And I think that actually works really well as an explanation for why you can't just occasionally use lightning. It might not seem very intuitive to some people that you can't just get away with it every few months or whatever, but I actually like the idea that it's just not a path that you can start down in dribs and drabs, that it's fundamentally some kind of evil tendril is working its way into your psyche when you use those types of actions, even if they might seem useful in the moment.
You know, the best part of Revenge of the Sith to me, and why I put it in a separate category from the other two in the prequels, is you saw the moral logic and you saw the temptation of Anakin and how it could actually be compelling, because what you know Palpatine is doing is saying to this very, very, very powerful Jedi, essentially just whispering in his ear constantly, you can have more. And he's not saying you can have more toward to be evil. It's you can have more and save your wife.
Yeah.
You know, you can have more. And then the Jedi are saying, no more. You should not have more. And Palpatine is there saying, why not? Why wouldn't the Jedi want you to have a wife? Why wouldn't the Jedi want you to save your wife? So just as Eric was saying, but that to have more meant tapping into the Sith well. And it makes sense to me to have this sort of category that only the masters, the Jedi masters, of knowledge that only Jedi masters can access, because essentially if the fundamental lure of the Sith is more power, and then you're a master and you have an enormous amount of power as a master, it's the formation of the character that makes you become a that enables you to be a master is also the character that enables you to handle some of the more powerful elements of the Jedi Order. But always the Sith are there like more, more, more. You can have more just this bit. And And again, I think what Eric said about how this sort of connects with our real world makes a lot of sense, because if you look at it as sipping from the wrong well, think about, like, for example, in our own world, the power of a simple little lie. A lie can be very powerful. It can be something that enables you to escape from difficult circumstances. It can cause you, it's something that can enable you to obtain an advantage over another person. And maybe you even lie with a greater good in mind, but it's sipping from that poison well. That's, you know, sipping from the dark side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, if you're a master, there is less that the Sith can tempt you with. I mean,
right.
You're, unless you're Yoda, you're not at the absolute top of the Jedi hierarchy. And so there's always more that you could theoretically get. But it's easy to understand why there is much more concern about the Sith whispering in the ear of a Padawan or youngling, even just a regular Jedi Knight, because there's so much more that they could have, that that temptation to get it by going through the Sith path is stronger than it is for somebody who's already maybe at the 90th percentile or the 95th percentile of the Jedi. I mean, they've already got so much that that lure is just fundamentally, it's less powerful.
I'm curious about Haley. Like, when did the book start to get too dark for you? Like,
oh, it was early on, dude. he was just so, like, I don't know. There was never a point, it felt to me, where he could have been the good guy. And he had, there were parts where there were characters I liked who weren't him. I can't remember the name of the guy, but his sword, like the sword master.
Kasim.
Yeah, I liked him. I don't know why. I felt like he was like less evil compared to the other ones. I felt like he had friends in his like infantry unit or whenever he was like a grunt. I liked the interplay of that when he sort of was helping people. Because there was that whole scene where he helped them with that battle when I think their leadership was just sort of throwing them as like cannon fodder. And I did like that scene a lot. But I like he just was so angry. And this brings me to a larger point I wanted to get to. David, you write a newsletter on Sundays for The Dispatch about religion in America. I thought you might have thoughts on the religion in Star Wars. Predestination, like to me it seemed like Darth Bane never really had a chance to turn to the light side, and I know in movies, in the shows, and there's this sort of intimation that the Force uses people. There's two different sides of the Force, implying it's the same entity, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the dark side, there's the light side. It's sort of gross, like that the Force would I don't know, manipulate people to turn to the dark side or to do that sort of thing, to establish balance in the galaxy or that sort of thing. What do you think of that? Do you feel like Darth Bane had a chance to turn to the light side? Do you give him the agency to have had that decision, because everything in his life leading up to that sort of pushed him towards that?
That's a really good an interesting question, and something that a lot of people have talked about the sort of Star Wars mythology, is it sort of a yin and yang kind of fate oriented kind of ethos and metaphysics, or is it that there is a purpose and an intention and a design to it, which would sort of make the Force seem to be less of sort of a passive kind of power that knits the universe together, and more of a power with an intention,
right?
And in that context, I feel like if you're going to pull into Return of the Jedi and everything, it does seem to me that even a person who taps as deeply into the darkness as Anakin did, as Darth Vader, that even at that moment, as deeply as he had drunk from the well of darkness, he was not too far. But at the same time, that feels a little bit off from much of the rest of the ethos, or the metaphysics, which essentially says, once you drink, once you move to the dark side, that's that. But it is, it's been a long, long, long time since I have dived into the whole, is it the Revan arc? That is that, the dark Jedi. I think I would need to remember some of that. But it, to me, it's an open question, quite frankly, because I don't think that the, you know, the people who sort of picked up the torch and carried it really thought about this that much, because prophecy and everything is kind of a device that's used in all. It's hard to think of a fantasy or sci-fi storyline, epic one, that doesn't contain some element of prophecy. But I do feel like there's a, you know, I don't think they ever resolved what if the Force has a will. And that seems, that's a pretty big hole in the universe.
Can I posit something? I just, as you were talking about that, David, I was thinking about Anakin versus Darth Bane, and does Bane ever really have a chance? And I think, I don't know if this is the intention of the creators and writers of Star Wars, but a really key difference between Anakin and a character like Bane is that Anakin has experienced love before, and he has been loved, and he has loved others. And occasionally that love, you know, ended up being a corrupting force because it was possessive. But it's something, he has had those positive emotions before. And with Bane, we see in his upbringing, you know, his father was awful to him and abusive. His mother died. He's living in this really horrible situation. And really the only positive relationships that he has are first with this kind of bar owner on the mining planet where he lives, and then his comrades in arms in the military. But even those relationships, they're loyalty, but they're not love. And I think that part of the reason that Bane perhaps never had a choice in what he became is in large part due to his situation and the fact that he never had that kind of positive influence or even that feeling of being cherished by someone and knowing what that could be like. So of course he wouldn't choose the light side, because he's never had the light side, metaphorically speaking, in his life. He's always just on a purely metaphorical basis relied on and been surrounded by the dark side of life. And I think that can take away someone's choice, is the situations that you are born in and raised in. And at a certain point, you've been conditioned to not even know that there is an alternative. So maybe that's a deeper reading of it than was intended, but I think that perhaps helps to explain why a character like Bane would just go completely evil without even considering the light side, because he fundamentally doesn't know what the light side is.
I think that's a powerful point. I mean, it's what you're saying is he never ever drank from the well of goodness at all and didn't know the taste of that at all. Whereas Anakin, yeah, I think that's a really interesting insight.
And it also connects to the idea of like love and attachment and why it can be dangerous in certain forms and healthy in others. You know, Vader was sort of saved through the expression of selfless love, right? The kind of love that the Jedi sort of want to champion, the kind of attachment that is healthy, right? But you can imagine the kind of love. I mean, we don't really have to imagine it, because we saw that this is actually what kickstarted Anakin's fall to become Vader, is the other kind of love, where it's possessive love. And it gives you a sense of like, okay, you know, it's not just like love can save people. Love is inherently good, because it's all about where you let that love take you. Do you let it make you into a better person, or do you let it lock you down and make you afraid and make you grab onto things and hold on tighter in, again, a corrupting way, as David was saying earlier? And so that, I think, is a really great illustration of why certain people who might have similar circumstances can branch off in different directions. It's all about, are they engaging with other people selflessly? Are they the recipient of selfless love, or perhaps the giver of selfless love? Or are they in a situation where some some people might call it love, but it actually has this insidious kind of really problematic attachment and fixation embedded in it.
That is a great point. I am out of
questions.
We're
going deep. We're going
deep.
Yeah,
for real. Does anyone have any final thoughts, anything they want to add to this discussion?
Can I just take a really brief moment just to complain?
Yes, let's talk about Githany.
Let's talk about Githany, who is a character in the first book, and she sucks. And I don't blame her, to paraphrase Jessica Rabbit. She's not bad. She's just written that way. And she's just kind of the classic female side character who's like really hot and sultry and seductive, and she's super powerful, almost as powerful as she is hot. Did we mention she's hot?
Wait, Grace, is she hot?
She's so hot, guys. But oh no, she's not as powerful as the main male character, and she has feelings for him that are complicating her life, and she's sad about it, but in a really hot way, and her clothes cling to her.
But like, how hot though?
Her clothes cling to her, Eric.
I feel like, David, from what you have told me about what's her name from the next books, that
Xana.
Maybe there is an alternative for the female character. Although I did read in the Wikipedia that she is strikingly attractive.
She's hot.
So that the hotness did make it into that character as well. But at least I think the romance arc is not there.
Let me just say the power dynamic and a different. There's a profoundly different power dynamic between Xana and Bane. That is interesting, because at some point you begin to realize, wait a minute, who's the master and who's the apprentice, and who's really, is she just basically using him? Is she kind of toying with him at this point, mm-hmm. to make sure that she has taken all the power and knowledge from him that she can? And the final confrontation is really good. And really interesting. But yeah,
as long as she's hot.
there's no question that was a priority for Cithery, apparently. So I don't know.
Well, I have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much, David, for taking the time to chat with us about Star Wars. David, do you have any final thoughts?
I just want to say thank you for graciously allowing me to invite myself on your podcast.
it was welcome.
Super fun.
Yeah.
It's a little presumptuous, but I appreciate you let me join.
We enjoyed it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much, David.
Well, thank you, guys.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com. or find us on Twitter at Hoth Takes. I'm at Burdenator on Twitter, and Eric is at Eric Geller. Grace is at Grace_Seegers. David is at David A. French. I made our wonderful logo and banner art, and Eric edited the show and put together our music, although for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.